Yes. Okay, today? Okay, I'm sorry. There is kids' class. Kids can be dismissed. Rest of you kids will be in here. We're in the book of what?
Revelation.
We've been looking at the seven churches in chapters 2 and 3. What was the name of the first church we looked at? Ephesus. Second one was?
Smyrna.
Third one was? Pergamum. Fourth one? Thyatira. Fifth one?
Sardis.
And today? Philadelphia. And next Sunday? Laodicea. Glad y'all knew them, because I didn't.
Right here.
Yeah. I figured out after about two of them where you was getting the info from. Let's look on the back of your handout. We looked at this a couple of weeks ago. I didn't have it all filled in, and I went ahead and filled in next week's as well for Laodicea, so it will be complete. But you'll see the seven churches, and you see each church has an order to the letters of each one. There are similarities in them, and there are about six things there that you'll find almost universally in each of the churches. First one is a description of Jesus, then there's a commendation, then a condemnation, then an exhortation, then the phrase about those who overcome, and then the last phrase, he who has. All right, you'll notice, and while we're kind of here, we'll just kind of look through this just a little bit. You'll notice the last one, he who has, that phrase is used exactly the same for all seven churches. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. So that's the only one of these things that is exactly the same for each one of them. If you look back at the top at the description of Jesus, a lot of these descriptions, we'll just kind of read crossways left to right. It starts out, the description of Jesus is he who holds the seven stars in his right hand and walks in the midst of the seven golden candle or lampstands. Then the next one, he who is the first and the last, who was dead and came to life. He who has a sharp two-edged sword. The Son of God, who has eyes like a flame of fire and feet like fine brass. He who has the seven spirits of God and the seven stars. And today we'll be looking at he who is holy, he who is true, he who has the key of David, he who opens and no man shuts, he who shuts and no man opens. And then next week you'll see the Amen, the faithful and true witness, the beginning of the creation of God. Commendations, things that Jesus says good about the churches. You go across there, each one of them starts with the four words, I know your works. And you'll see that of the seven, five of them, there are no commendations. Last week, John talked about Sardis, and next week, Laodicea. Not much good to say about, Jesus has not much good to say about those two churches. Condemnation is next. You'll see likewise there are two churches that there is no condemnation. Smyrna, the second church, and the one we'll be looking at today, Philadelphia. Exhortation, different things there going across that Jesus exhorts each of these churches to do. It looks like the exhortation gets a little longer as the letters go across. And then those who overcome, look what he says about that. The first one, they will eat of the tree of life. They shall not be hurt by the second death. I will give hidden manna to eat and a white stone with a name no one else can read. I will give power over the nations and the morning star. They will be clothed with white raiment. I will not blot his name from the book of life. I will confess his name before my Father and his angels. Today, we'll see that he who overcomes, I will make him a pillar in the temple of my God, and he shall go out no more. I will write on him the name of my God and the name of the city of my God, the new Jerusalem, which comes down out of heaven, and I will write on him my new name. And then next week I will grant to sit with me on my throne as I also overcame and sat down with my Father on his throne. Of these seven churches, which one or two do you think you would most rather have been in to have gotten the letter? Do what? Philadelphia or Smyrna. Why is that? Okay, he didn't say anything bad about them. So, you know, if we're going to pick a church that we would have rather have been in that church, it might have been Philadelphia and Smyrna. There's no condemnation given to either of those churches. It's interesting that I read this past week that of these seven cities, which two do you think still exist today? It's those two, Smyrna, Philadelphia, and Turkey. They go by a different name, but same location, same town. That's interesting. Which two would you have rather not been in to gotten a letter from Jesus Christ? All right, the two he had nothing good to say about, right? Laodicea and Sardis. I was thinking last night of these words. How many of you know cities by these names, or perhaps churches by these names? There's a Sardis, I think it's a General Baptist church down outside of Quitman, to west of Quitman, I believe it's the right direction. Sardis. Of course, we know, familiar with Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. That's probably the most common one of these. Do you know towns or cities or churches by these names? Okay, you can look them up. I started last night and thought, well, that's going to take forever, so I quit. But just curious to see how many of these names are the names of towns in Arkansas or in Kansas or in Missouri or whatever. All right, they're pretty common. The most uncommon one is, which one would you think? Laodicea. All right, Laodicea for the name of a church is sort of like Jezebel for the name of your daughter. Okay, you don't see many churches named Laodicea Baptist Church or Methodist Church or whatever. All right, perhaps some, but not much. And it's because we'll be more familiar with the text next week than perhaps any of these seven churches. That text is the most familiar to us, and it's not a very rosy picture. And so that's probably the cause of that. Well, today we're looking at Philadelphia, the church of the open door. We're in the third chapter of Revelation, verses 7 to 13. So let's read our text. And to the angel of the church in Philadelphia write, these things says he who is holy, he who is true, he who has the key of David, he who opens and no man shuts, and shuts and no one opens. I know your works. See, I have set before you an open door, and no one can shut it. For you have a little strength, have kept my word, and have not denied my name. Indeed, I will make those of the synagogue of Satan, who say they are Jews and are not, but lie. Indeed, I will make them come and worship before your feet and to know that I have loved you. Because you have kept my command to persevere, I also will keep you from the hour of trial which shall come upon the whole world to test those who dwell on the earth. Behold, I am coming quickly. Hold fast what you have, that no one may take your crown. He who overcomes, I will make him a pillar in the temple of my God, and he shall go out no more. I will write on him the name of my God and the name of the city of my God and the new Jerusalem, which comes down out of heaven from my God. And I will write on him my new name. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. So let's see what we have in this letter. Philadelphia. We're familiar with that name. The word, as you probably know, comes from two Greek words. Phileo, which is one of the words for love. So you have love, and then Delphos is the name for brother. The word means the city of brotherly love or brotherly love. So the church or the town of Philadelphia was a fairly new town. It's the youngest of the seven cities that we have looked at. It was founded in around 150 B.C., I believe, if I remember correctly, by the ruler of the city of Pergamos. And it was founded and given as an act of love from the ruler of Pergamos to his brother. Hence the name of the city, Brotherly Love, Philadelphia. By the time this letter is getting to the church at Philadelphia, the church was been about 250 years old, or approximately the age of the United States of America. Now, I don't consider that a very young city myself, but in Europe, perhaps it is. A lot of things in Europe are older than we're accustomed to in the United States. The city was founded with a purpose. The purpose was to be an open city and encourage and promote inclusiveness from all other cities around and other areas around to come, because the idea was to be, and this is using quotes, a missionary, a Greek missionary city. And the idea was to promote Greek culture, to promote Greek ideas, Greek philosophy, Greek ways of life. And so that was the intent of the city, was to be an open city that promoted and tried to proselyte, you might say, other cultures around them. An earthquake struck this area in 17 AD and destroyed, I believe it was Sardis, and 10 other cities in that area, completely destroyed them. Which Sardis, of course, was rebuilt by the time the letter got to them that we looked at last week. However, in Philadelphia, the tremors, the aftershocks, we might say, the tremors after that massive earthquake were felt for years, according to history. And regularly, they would feel aftershocks and feel tremors, such that the city was hard to inhabit. It's hard to find someone who wanted to live there because they were constantly having to leave or out of fear and coming and going, and it was not a comfortable situation. And there's a phrase or two later on in our text that perhaps alludes to that, because the people, it is said, would not stay there. Someone may be brave enough to stay there, and those people were looked at as crazy and as lunatics to go there, because then an aftershock would come and they would flee the city again. So they were getting out where they could live and around it in wide open spaces. It was a city also that changed its name a couple of times. One of the Roman emperors, I can't remember his name, but at one point the city renamed itself Neo Caesarea, which means the new Caesar. It later changed its name again to Flavia, which was the family name for the Vespasian family of rulers. But it changed it back to Philadelphia, I think, you know, back and forth. So the city didn't always keep its name Philadelphia, but for the most part, that was what it was called. And again, we may have reference to that later in our text this morning as well. So here is the city of the open door. There are churches called open door churches. Non-denominational, usually type churches. The one that I'm familiar with promotes homosexuality, Church of the Open Door. So you can't always go by a name necessarily. But let's look at the letter. It starts out with a description of Jesus in verse 7. These things says he, and he lists about four things. It starts with he who is holy. He who is holy. Jesus is referencing himself as holy. He who is holy. The word holy means set apart. A set apart one. A holy one. The second thing he mentions is he who is true. And here you can look at the word true a couple of different ways. And this is a specific way of using the word true. It's not true as in contrasted with false. It's not true as contrasted with a lie. The idea that he who is true, it's a reference to what is real compared to what is not real. He who is holy, he who is the real one, he who is real, he who is true. And then he gives us another phrase that is actually a quote from Isaiah. He who has the key of David, he who opens and no one shuts, and shuts and no one opens. You can go to Isaiah 22 and also back to 2 Kings, and I don't remember the chapter in 2 Kings, but Hezekiah was the king. And Hezekiah had a trusted servant named Eliakim. And Eliakim was such a trusted servant that Isaiah mentions to us that Hezekiah gives him the key to the city. Now that's probably a symbolic act, but it's said in Isaiah that he gives him the key. He has the key to the city, the key of David, city of Jerusalem. He has the key of David. And what he opens, no man can shut. And what he shuts, no man can open. Now this is a reference that Jesus is saying. These things, as I write to the church of Philadelphia, these things I am saying, I am the one who has the key of David. I am the one who what I open, no man can shut. I am the one who what I shut, no man can open. All right, so with that context, what does the key of David refer to? Okay, I think it is probably authority. Person who has the key. Person who has the key to their business, a plant, or the house, or whatever the case may be, is someone who is trusted to start with, and someone who has authority to let in whoever they want to let in, to keep out whoever they want to keep out. So what Jesus probably is referring to here when he says, I am he who has the key of David. I am he who opens and no man shuts. I am he who shuts and no man opens. He is referring to authority. I am the one with all authority. And then he gets to the commendation, verses 8 and parts of 9 and 10. Verse 8, he says, I know your works. See, I have set before you an open door. Now, this idea of an open door is not new to the New Testament. Paul, several times in the book of Acts and his other letters of Paul, mentions an open door being given to him to enter a certain city or certain area on his missionary travels. This idea, this terminology, is not something that is new to the book of Revelation, and we use it in our mission efforts or our evangelistic efforts. We talk about an open door, praying that God would give us an open door to minister in Guatemala, to minister in Burma, to minister in Cleveland County, to give us an open door to minister to people that come to the Feed the Sheep shop or whatever the case may be. We are familiar with that usage of this word. The city was already designated as an open door city by the Greek. And perhaps the church was making good use of that idea. He says in verse 8, I have set before you an open door, and no one can shut it. Going back to the previous declaration of him being the one who opens and shuts. So Jesus tells the church, you're in a place where there's an open door to minister. You're in a place where there's an open door to evangelize. And no one will shut the door except by my permission or by my authority. He goes on and says in verse 8, for you have a little strength. Does that sound like a commendation? Not much of a commendation, is it? You have a little strength. All right? I would prefer that someone say about me spiritually, he is a strong person. But that isn't what he says. But he doesn't say you have no strength. You have a little strength. The next one, you have kept my word. Would you like to hear Jesus say that about you? You have kept my word. I'd like that. I would like that. You have not denied my name. Would you like to hear the Lord say that about you? You have not denied my name. I used to think I had never done that. But sometimes I wonder if our silence perhaps is a denial. Sometimes we might need to speak when we are silent. Then, the last part of verse 9, well, let's read the whole verse. He says, indeed, I will make those of the synagogue of Satan who say they are Jews and are not, but lie. Indeed, I will make them come and worship before your feet and to know that I have loved you. So here, Jesus mentions someone who he says is of the synagogue of Satan. Now, I don't know, that perhaps is like John Boehner calling Ted Cruz Lucifer in the flesh. You know, I don't, maybe that's just a terminology that gives us the idea that this is a wicked idea, a wicked place or wicked group. But there's a group that he is calling, saying they are the synagogue of Satan, who say they are Jews, but they're not. Now, I'm not sure what the significance of claiming to be Jews would be. I don't know. But Jesus says, there will come the day when I will make them come and worship at your feet. Now, there again, I don't think that Jesus is condoning one person coming and worshiping another person. I don't think that's what he's saying. Because this phrase you'll find in the book of Isaiah a number of times, in the book of Zechariah a time or two. And the idea was that God was, through Isaiah the prophet and through Zechariah, was telling Israel that your enemies, the people who are tormenting you now, I will judge them and they will come and bow before your feet. Now, he doesn't mean that they're going to come and worship you. It just means that they're going to acknowledge that your God is the God. And that's, I think, what the idea that he's getting across here. He says, I will make them come, and the day will come when they will acknowledge that your God is right, that I am the Lord. And then in verse 10, because you have kept my command to persevere. Again, that is a phrase that I would delight in God saying to me. You have persevered in your faith. You have persevered. You have obeyed my commands, kept my commands to persevere. So here are some commendations that Jesus makes to the church at Philadelphia that, and it looks to me like, and we could go back and compare the other churches, but if there is a church that is more highly commended than this one, I don't remember which one it was. Perhaps Smyrna. But Jesus tells this church, even though you have little strength, you have kept my word, you have not denied my name, you have persevered, and those who hate you will see that I love you. Then we get to the condemnation. Again, there is nothing in this letter of what Jesus condemns them. The only hint of any negative thing you might see was that word a little. You have a little strength. If there's anything negative that he tells the church that I see, that was perhaps the only thing. So we go to exhortation. What does he exhort this church to do? He exhorts them to keep on, because the day will come when those who will worship at your feet, who will acknowledge that I am your Lord and I am the God. So he exhorts them to hold on, to keep on, to acknowledge the truth. Notice what he says in verse 10. Because you have kept my command to persevere, I also will keep you from the hour of trial which shall come upon the whole world to test those who dwell on the earth. Now, there's a difference of opinion about what this trial is. Notice what he says, I will keep you from the hour of trial, from the period of time of great trial or testing, which he says will come upon the whole world and to test those who dwell on the earth. Now, when is that time? I can't tell you specifically. There's primarily two suggestions that are given. And one is the time immediately after this, shortly after this, when Christians were persecuted greatly by Rome and by the Roman emperors. Perhaps that is the time that he is talking about. If it is the time, then you have to explain that word whole world, and you have to explain the idea of those who dwell on the earth. Now, there is a legitimate way to use language such as whole world and not really mean everybody that lives on the earth. There's a way to use our language that way that does not violate truth. And I'll just give you an example of how you could do that. Suppose that the governor, I started to say Donald Trump, but I don't want to talk about Donald Trump. Let's say the governor, Asa Hutchinson, comes to Heber Springs, and he visits Heber Springs during the 4th of July or whatever. And there's a big crowd comes to wherever he's speaking, and he's there. And the next week in the newspaper, the headlines read this: all of Cleburne County comes to welcome the governor. Do you think that when you read that every single person came to welcome the governor? No. Do you think the writer of the newspaper intended to convey that? No. We understand that use of language. It just means a gob of folks, right? Lots of people came. Big crowds there. They came to welcome the governor. But we know that the intent was not to try to tell us that every person was there. And that perhaps is the usage of this word here, where he says, I will keep you from the hour of trial, which shall test the whole world. It might just mean there will be a large group of people that this will affect. A large group, maybe in their known world, the world that's close enough to them that they would hear news of it. The other idea is that this is not a reference to Christian persecution in the first 100 or 200 years A.D., but it's a reference to the end times and what will be a great time of testing and great time of trouble and great time of tribulation right immediately prior to Jesus' return to the earth. Perhaps that's the other idea. One of those two is generally believed to be, that's what the reference is there. I don't know which it is. I tend to lean toward the first one myself, that it's Christian persecution, just because the Church of Philadelphia is come and gone. And Jesus hasn't come back yet. So that's my thought, maybe not. But someone has mentioned that the Church of Philadelphia still exists. There are Christians in Philadelphia. There is a bishop and 1,000 Christians or so in that area. So perhaps it may be a reference to that. 2 or 3 weeks ago, I was listening, just happened to turn on the radio or TV or something. It was David Jeremiah was preaching, and he just happened to be preaching on the third chapter of Revelation and just happened to be talking about the Church of Philadelphia. And I knew that was going to be my sermon. I listened for a little while to him. And he is of the opinion that we talked about this a few weeks ago as well, that these seven churches represent seven ages. And this Philadelphia period of time is immediately prior to or close proximity to the end times. And, of course, Laodicea would be the church that exists at the end times, and the other churches go back through history. For the life of me, I just can't see that. I don't know who it is that says, okay, the first church at Ephesus was from 90 A.D. to 200 A.D., then the next church at Smyrna, was from there to such and such. I don't know who makes those determinations of how you divide up those churches into 2,000 years of history. I can't do it, and it certainly you can't get it from the text. So I don't know, but he held to that view and was explaining it in that way. But let's move on. He says also in exhortations, "Behold, I come quickly. I come quickly," or "when I come, things will be happening fast." When things start to move, they will move quickly. So hold fast to what you have. When Jesus makes the statement, or when in the New Testament, or when Paul makes the statement in the New Testament, talking about the quick coming of the Lord, or the fact that when Christ comes, it will be suddenly. It will be like a thief in the night. It will be unexpected. It will happen soon and fast. That is a sort of like a two-sided coin. It's a warning on one side. It's a warning that you might ought to be prepared. You might ought to be ready. When Christ comes again, there is no time for preparation. The other side of that point is, it is comfort. It is a comfort to those, especially in perhaps this church or in the church of Smyrna, where there is suffering, where there is persecution. And it is a comfort to know that Christ is coming. He will be victorious in the end. We may suffer, we may be martyred, we may die for our faith. But just because they may kill us, they have not killed God. They have not killed Christ. They have not destroyed the Christian faith. And then, number 5, those who overcome. He says, "Those who overcome, I will make him a pillar in the temple of my God." Now, obviously, that's not a literal statement. He's not going to make them a pillar in the temple. It's a reference to being in the proximity of the presence of God. And he shall go out no more. Now here is perhaps a reference to the earthquakes that they've experienced, where the inhabitants of the city come and go in and out of the city, trying to live there a while, and then out of fear because of the tremors, they had left. He said, there will be no more of that, if that's what it's a reference to. They will dwell in the temple. There will be no more of this fear of living in fear. They will go out no more. I will write on him the name of my God and the name of the city of my God, the new Jerusalem which comes down out of heaven from my God. And I will write on him my new name. Some think that this perhaps is an allusion to the fact that the city of Philadelphia changed its name several times. Jesus says, those who overcome, I will write on them a name, my name. It could be a reference to slaves who were marked in some way on their body, an ownership mark of who they belong to. Jesus says there will be, in some way, you will know, the world will know, that you are mine, that you belong to me. Then he closes with the familiar phrase, he who has an ear, let him hear. As we've gone through these six churches and one more, it wouldn't surprise me if in every one of these churches, in every one of these letters, we can find things that perhaps we, I don't want to say have excelled at, but God could commend us for. And there are certainly probably things that we could find that we fit perhaps some of the condemnations as well. So as we read them, as we go through them, prepare to go through the rest of the book of Revelation, beginning in chapter 4 after next week, let's make ourselves a church, a people, who God would speak highly of. Let's pray. Lord God, help us to honor your word. And Lord, to honor you. God, help us that you might could say of us, we have not denied your name. We have kept your word. Father, give us the strength. Give us the grace, Lord, to persevere. Amen.